state, but I don't think it'd be.
Shines here.
Let's open the House Committee on Rural Communities Land Use and Water. Today is February the 5th, and I am going to start by opening a work session on House Bill 2047. And colleagues, as you'll recall, this is the bill we heard a little bit about last Tuesday regarding the technical fixes to the adjustments to the Washington County, particularly urban and rural reserves, that were made in the 2014 short session. And these are the places where, you know, we had the wrong tax lot number, we had, you know, the wrong southwest instead of south, those kind of things. So with that, I would entertain a motion if there's one to be had.
Chair Clem, I move HB 2047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Post moves House Bill 2047 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? No? This is exactly the same situation where, yeah. So would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. Motion passes and the bill is sent to the floor. So I'm trying to decide whether we should give this to a member or put it on the consent calendar. Do folks even know what the consent calendar is in across the board?
You should carry it, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, all right, I'll carry the bill. Yeah. Should I have a co-carrier and Representative Davis since he's not here to defend himself?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so Representative Davis and I will co-carry the bill. Okay, so let's close the work session, open an informational meeting, and ask the Department of State Lands to come up. Colleagues, I asked the agency to tell us a little bit about themselves before they start telling us about their bill concepts, just so we have some clue who they are, rather than just random information about topics we know nothing about, and we have no idea who's talking to us either. So please tell us a little bit about your agency and what you do, since you've got a name that sounds a lot like our committee name, so apparently we're your committee to deal with.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Abrams, and I'm the director of the Department of State Lands. So just to give you some basics around the department is the administrative arm for the State Land Board, and it implements a variety of the authorities and responsibilities that are designated to it by the board or by the legislature. So just as background, the State Land Board was established in the Constitution in 1859. It's composed of the governor, the secretary of state, and the state treasurer. And at the time that that Oregon became a state, the State Land Board received three basic responsibilities. The management of the lands that were given to the state by the federal government to fund schools, and the fund that would hold the monies that came from those lands. The administration of estates where there was no will and there was no apparent heir, and the management of state-owned waterways under the equal footing doctrine. So just to give you a little bit more background on those three responsibilities that were given to the land board at statehood, the first one is the one that we're most commonly known for. We received from the federal government as a state $3.4 million acres of lands. It was spread out across the state as the 16th and 36th section of each township. And these lands were known as constitutional or trust lands because they were given to the state in trust to fund education. Today, unfortunately, we only have about a fifth of those left. We had a pretty serious land scandal back in the early 1900s. But even with that, over the years, the revenues from those lands and from some other sources that I'll discuss have been managed for the Common School Fund, and they continue to be put into the corpus of that fund. The Oregon Constitution also assigned the land board as administrative estates for those people who died without a will and without any known heirs. The department administers those estates, and then after 10 years, if we don't find an heir, the proceeds from the estates escheat to the Common School Fund, so those funds also help to fund Oregon's K through 12 schools. And the last responsibility that the land board received at statehood was the management of Oregon's submerged and submersible lands in tidally influenced and navigable waterways, commonly known as the beds and banks of these waterways. And again, these passed under the equal footing doctrine, which said that each state that came into the union got the same rights and responsibilities as the original 13 states. The ownership of these waterways for the land board made it responsible to ensure that the public trust and the public had the right to use these lands for commerce, fisheries, navigation, and recreation. So that's sort of the background of how the land board came about. They ran those responsibilities until about 1878, and then the legislature decided that they needed some administrative help and created the clerk to the land board. And then in 1967, the office of the clerk was elevated to an agency, executive agency status. And then over time, the legislature also assigned the department a number of responsibilities. So in 1957, the legislature gave the implementation of the Unclaimed Property Act to the department. The Unclaimed Property Act requires that holders of property that have not been claimed by its rightful owners is reported to the state and handed over to the state to hold until the rightful owners are found. In 1967, the legislature assigned the removal fill law as one of the responsibilities to the department. And this is the law that regulates removal and fill from the waters of the state. And then in 1989, the legislature assigned implementation of the Wetlands Conservation Act to the department, and that included wetlands into the protection for the waters of the state. And finally, the last responsibility that was added to the department was the role of the state partner in a federal-state partnership between the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the state of Oregon as part of the National Estuarine Research Reserve, and that happened in 1974. Throughout all of this, our primary focus as a department is to implement the administrative work associated with the land board, which is the administration of the Common School Fund assets. These are both the invested assets as well as the real property assets. And we do this in order to help assure that the state land board meets its trust obligation to Oregon's K through 12 schools. The revenues from our constitutional and our statutory programs are deposited into the Common School Fund investment portfolio, and the operating costs for the department come from the Common School Fund. So we're an other-funded agency, not a general funded agency. The investment earnings from the Common School Fund are distributed twice a year to Oregon's 197 public school districts. And just as an example, in 2015, the annual distribution was a little bit over $54 million. So it's a small amount of the overall state education funding, but it's an important piece because it goes directly to those districts, and they are always appreciative of it. I'll give you a sense of our structure. We have 104 staff. The majority are here in Salem, but we do have two regional offices. Our office associated with the South Slough National Estuarine Research Reserve in Charleston, and our regional office out in Bend that covers most of our constitutional lands that are in rangelands out in southeastern Oregon. We did do a reorganization in 2014, so I'm going to run through the structure of the agency so that everybody will know where things are housed. We have the director's office, which oversees the department as well as the administrative and policy responsibilities for the state land board. We have the Common School Fund property program, and it administers and manages all the agency's upland real property as well as the trust property, which is the unclaimed property and the estates that escheat to the Common School Fund. This program is the primary source of revenue for the Common School Fund, so we obviously take it very seriously. We also, in terms of responding to our other responsibilities around the waterways of the state, have an aquatic resource management program, and the assistant director for that program, Bill Ryan, is with me here today to speak to you. That program conserves and protects waters of the state and assures the public's right to use those waters and of the state-owned navigable waterways. We've reorganized this group geographically, and so we have teams of staff that work with individual geographic regions and really try to provide a complete set of information in each region. And it administers the removal fill, the wetlands, and the proprietary work for the state's waterways. We organize the business operations for the department centrally, and so we have a business operations and support services program. It's responsible for the agency-wide implementation of our administrative, fiscal, human resources, information technology, and support functions. And it also provides the financial oversight for the common school fund and its distributions. And finally, we have the South SLU National Estuarine Research Reserve, which I've mentioned a couple of times. It's about 5,000 acres of research and education facility down in Charleston near Coos Bay, and it provides education and research on estuary issues to Oregonians, everything from very young students, preschoolers, to decision makers who are working on estuary issues. So I thought I'd move from that and talk just a little bit about some of the projects and accomplishments we've had over the last few years to give you a sense for the things we've been working on. We've been involved with several task force and work groups over the last few years to try and work better to get some of our work done more efficiently. We've had a rulemaking to allow remediation on the state-owned submerged and submersible lands, which we think will be very important as we address some of our waterways that have to be cleaned up, particularly the Portland Harbor area. We had a work group last year that worked on addressing ownership issues of historically filled submerged and submersible lands, an issue that can be very contentious, and it was a really productive work group. We were also very heavily involved in the governor's work group on the suction dredge mining issue that was raised during the last long session. All of these work groups, we really set them up to make provide a facilitated forum for people to come in and work with us and try and develop processes that will be more effective for working with our external stakeholders. Another project that's really kept us very engaged in the last couple of years is the Elliott State Forest. This is the first state forest for the state of Oregon, and it's 90% of it is constitutional trust lands. So it has an obligation to raise money for the schools and has been historically a big revenue generator for the Common School Fund. Unfortunately, with some listing of endangered species, listing of species under the Endangered Species Act, the harvest levels have really been limited. And so we've gone from having the Elliott be a primary contributor to actually being a cost for the Common School Fund. So the department has been working with the land board, with external stakeholders and with technical and agency experts to try and design a path forward for the forest that would allow the Common School Fund to remain whole from the value of that asset, and at the same time protect some of the local economic and conservation values that are really important in that forest. And on another bird issue, with the greater sage grouse, which is a bird out in eastern Oregon, there is some discussion about having it be listed under the Endangered Species Act, and we have over 600,000 acres of state-owned rangeland that could potentially be affected. So we've been working with our lessees of those lands, as well as with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to develop an agreement around the management of those lands. This is part of an overall public-private effort to try and provide sufficient protection so that the bird won't be listed. But if the bird were to be listed, the agreement, although it requires some conservation measures and protections, would also ensure that grazing and other agricultural uses could continue on our state-owned rangelands. The land board in 2009 took on an effort to try and stabilize the distributions out of the Common School Fund. As I said, they go to the schools twice a year, And it's really helpful for the financial planning for the schools if they can have some assurance of what that distribution might be. And so in an effort to stabilize the distribution so that they didn't have wide swings, the land board established a new distribution policy in 2009, which links the distribution to the three-year rolling average of the corpus of the fund as of the investment part of the fund portfolio. And this policy has really helped to stabilize the distribution, which has been a great advantage for the schools. Finally, we do have some work on customer service that we've been engaged in, and I'll describe a few of the projects that we've been involved with. But we do biennial customer service surveys, and we've seen a continual growth in a continual increase and improvement in the ratings of excellent or good over the years since we started that survey. That was in 2007, and every year we've gone up. We think this really reflects some of the efforts that we've had. And some of those efforts include improving the unclaimed property reporting and outreach, which has really not only improved the customer satisfaction, but really has been allowed us to get the unclaimed property reported to us at a higher level, which we think is a great advantage, because then we can turn around and work to find the rightful owners. And we have also had an increase in the number of dollars that we've returned to rightful owners over the past few years. We've also worked with the regional solutions teams, and many of you have those groups in your communities. And we work to try and streamline some of our permitting requirements and help with economic development out in other parts of Oregon. And probably our big achievement in the past couple of years has been some work around Albany, Corvallis, and Lebanon, where we've improved the permitting to a point that we can expedite permits for almost 20 of the industrial sites that are down there. And we're really hoping the same process can be used in other parts of the state. The last thing I'll mention is that we do have, as I mentioned, a large number of acres of rangelands out in southeastern Oregon. Some of those have the ability to be developed for irrigated agriculture. So in 2011, we started a program with interested lessees to convert some of those to irrigated agriculture. And the program has been very successful. We've had a lot of interest from our lessees, so that we anticipate by the end of this year that we'll have more than 1,000 state-owned acres in irrigated agriculture. This is a real help for the Common School Fund, because the irrigated agriculture produces mostly alfalfa hay, which gives a much higher rate of return than the grazing lands do. So that's the overview of the agency. I'll just run through quickly the legislative bills that we have coming before you, and then there's one in the Senate, and then we'll go into more detail. I can take questions, and then we can move into more detail on the bills if people would like. So we have four House bills that will be in front of you this afternoon. House Bill 2460, which is for an administrative fee for processing utility easement applications.
Let's stop, take questions, okay. And then we'll just go through it bill by bill, and I'll open each one and go through it.
Okay.
So any questions for the moment about agency operations, what they do, any issues? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given our agenda here in these bills, I just wanted to ask you and the director if there's an opportunity in the session to discuss more in depth the Elliott Forest. I'm very interested in that, and I would like it if we could come back and delve into that a bit.
Yeah, I'm trying to gauge the amount of time this list of utilities that want to talk about 2460 is going to take. So maybe at the end of the meeting, maybe later.
I didn't mean today.
Yeah.
I just want to go on record that we can get back to that this session.
Yeah, absolutely. That's
great.
Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Abrams, I've received a lot of email and written letters wondering what the State Land Board has done to defend its ability to continue to positively contribute to the Common School Fund rather than being a drain. And those questions are, have we defended our legal right to be able to harvest timber on our state forest as the Constitution suggests that we should be?
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, We certainly believe that we have done all the legal due diligence on that question. We have a little bit of a, as often happens with regulatory issues, we have a little bit of a conflict. We have the constitutional requirement to make money off of these lands, but at the same time, there's a general restriction to protect Endangered Species Act, which applies to all people in the United States. And that does include, of course, landowners of forest lands, and we're one of those. We did consult widely, both with our own council over the issues that were raised around the Elliott, and we also consulted with some very highly experienced Endangered Species Act attorneys, and they all gave us the same advice, which is what we followed, which has gotten us to the point where we are. So we believe that we have followed exactly the legal requirements that we needed to. It's an unfortunate situation, and the land board is very interested in trying to find a way to work through it without losing the resources for the Common School Fund.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and like Representative Gilliam, I too would like an opportunity more in depth to be able to discuss this if it was ever a possibility.
We'll definitely have the time. No problem there. Representative McClain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, you mentioned the irrigated agriculture in alfalfa hay has produced some value. How did the Division of State Lands acquire water rights in order to irrigate the acreage?
Chair Clem, Representative McClain, we acquired our water rights exactly the same way any private landowner would do. We either had them from earlier rights, or we purchased them through the normal process through the Department of Water Resources.
A couple of follow-ups.
Sure.
My understanding is DSL is irrigating from groundwater withdrawal. Is that true?
Chair Clem, Representative McClain, that is generally true.
My understanding is that perhaps the water right permits for groundwater withdrawal were obtained through an application process as opposed to acquisition, like purchasing water rights. Is that true?
Chair Clem, Representative McClain, I can't tell you the specifics of every one of our water rights, but my understanding has been that we have gone through the normal process that any landowner would go through.
And then my last question, were you aware that many of the ranchers located near the DSL properties have alleged that DSL receive preferential treatment in the water application process? In other words, as you know, irrigated agriculture makes land more valuable. But you're also next to some folks who have been waiting for years and years and years to get through this process, and then DSL applied and got it fast-tracked. Assuming that's true, what would be your response to the Water Resources Department giving preferential treatment to the Department of State Lands?
Chair Clem, Representative McClain, I have heard this before and I've checked on it. We have not received any preferential treatment. We have applied. The Department of Water Resources has a fast-track program, and there are private individuals who use it, and we use that program as well, but no differently, and received no treatment other than what would have been given to to a regular private landowner. That's my understanding.
Well, my second final. To the extent the Department of State Lands goes into competition with private industry, and to the extent private industry depends upon government regulation in order to engage in business, there becomes an inherent conflict of interest. And my recommendation to you is, since these rumors pervade, is that the Department of State Lands probably needs to look back at that. And to the extent you acquire or seek to acquire or put more acreage into irrigated agriculture, to make sure that you're not getting preferential treatment. it is grotesquely unfair for the government on one hand to compete with ranchers and farmers, and then on the other hand to be treated better than they're treated by a different agency of the same government. And because I think if it continues, sooner or later this legislature will have to investigate to see whether this has been a proper acquisition of a water right.
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I will definitely take your advice and go back and look at how we acquired those water rights. And I know that we have had continuing discussions with the ranchers around the area, and I'll just check in and make sure that that's going the way that you feel that it ought to be handled. And I'll be glad to report back to you if you would like that.
I'd appreciate that. If you could get back to me and our chairman, that would be great.
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, I'll be glad to do that.
Thank you.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Chair Clem, and thank you, Director, for being here today and for providing this background information. The Common School Fund has a long and meaningful history of dispersing funds to our local schools, and we all appreciate that. I wonder if there's been any recent or perhaps planned conversations about reviewing the formula by which those funds are distributed to local schools.
Chair Clem and Representative Gomberg, I have not heard of any discussion about that. We do routinely have, because we have under the current distribution policy, which is really the distribution from the corpus of the Common School Fund. It's not the distribution to the schools themselves. That usually is a question every year, because there's usually some need, and so people want to know if there's a possibility of getting more money from the Common School Fund. In terms of the formula, if I understand your question correctly, on which schools get which amounts, that is a formula that is crafted by the Department of Education, and we provide the funds to the Department of Education, and then that goes on out from there.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the context to my question is this. My understanding of that formula is that funds are dispersed to counties and then to school districts based on the population in those counties of young people up to the age of 20, with, of course, the high school graduation age being somewhat lower than that, which suggests to me, particularly since that fund is now going to be augmented by a portion of the taxes generated by recreational marijuana sales, that some counties may have a disproportionate number of students between the typical age of high school graduation and the age 20. And it seems to me that there might be some more equitable alternatives to what we're currently doing if we were trying to actually disperse funds based on the number of students that are in the classroom.
Chair Clem, Representative Gomberg, I can go back and look at the formula that is used. It is the standard formula that's used to distribute funds, and so I have heard this comment previously, because it's a formula that we have not developed. We haven't been involved that much in the conversation, but I'll be glad to go back and check and see how that formula is put together and respond back to you. We don't have any, our biggest concern is making sure that the fund is managed in a way as a solid endowment, so that there continues to be a long-term source of funding from the Common School Fund, and how the monies that come out of the school fund are then distributed to the counties is something that, you know, we're not really, have not been concerned with in particular.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Director. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so why don't we get into the bills? So what I will do is close our information meeting, and I'm just going to go through them one by one. I'll open all four, so you can go through them one by one, so you don't have to keep coming back up. Right now, there's only one that has anybody else signed up to talk, but I'll let you just go through all four of them. Why don't you do 2460 last, so it's the one freshest in our mind when the other folks come up to talk about it, unless I'm missing something.
No.
We're going to check and see if anybody else is here on 2460 1, 2, or 3. Nope. Thank you. So why don't we do 2461 first, and then 62, then 63, then 60.
Okay.
So I'll open a public hearing on House Bills 2460, 2461, 2462, and 2463. And I'll let you go through all your portions, but in that order I just outlined.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Chair Clem. Again, for the record, my name is Mary Abrams, and I'm the Director of the Department of State Lands. For House Bill 2461, I have with me today the Assistant Director for Aquatic Resources Management, Bill Ryan, and he's going to present the testimony on that. Bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Ryan. I'm the Assistant Director of the Aquatic Resources Management Program at the Department of State Lands, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2461. So the bill would add language back to ORS 274.043 to allow the Department of State Lands to continue offering lower cost registrations for small non-commercial structures on state-owned submerged and submersible lands. Those are the navigable waterways that the state assumed ownership of at statehood. Since 1998, the department has offered these lower cost registrations for such uses as docks and boathouses, once again non-commercial, on waterways such as Devil's Lake and the Willamette River. In 2011, the legislature passed Senate Bill 600, which changed our the rules or changed the statutes regarding our leasing requirements, providing mostly exemptions for various types of uses. Inadvertently, language was removed from the statute that allowed the department to establish registrations through rulemaking for low-cost and non-commercial structures. And so we encourage passing this statute to allow us to offer these lower-cost registrations to literally thousands of property owners who have benefited from this over the many years. And thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions about this one? Okay, I'll leave the hearing on it open in case you think of something later. All right, let's move on to 2462.
Okay, Chair Clem and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Mary Abrams. I'm the Director of the Department of State Lands. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 2462. So as I mentioned earlier when I described the history of the and the functions of the Department of State Lands, we have a lot of responsibilities that were given to us early on in terms of maintaining the records for property that the state owns. And one of these was that we retain copies, actually the originals of any property transaction documents for any state agency in the state of Oregon. So this bill, House Bill 2462, would allow the department, instead of maintaining the originals and having the other agencies maintain their copies, maintain electronic copies of these documents. This really is a sort of an outdated requirement before the time of a lot of electronic abilities for record and documentation, and we believe that this would decrease our administrative burden and the cost of maintaining paper copies. It would also allow the agencies that are involved with these property transactions to hold on to their own original documents. The way the current statute is written, it really perpetuates the use of paper files, which is a more expensive means of archiving. And this House bill would allow for the electronic opportunity, which is cheaper and more common. House Bill 2462 would amend ORS 273099 to allow the agency to fulfill the statutory obligation by retaining an electronic rather than a paper copy of land transactions, such as sales, acquisitions, and exchanges. It would also remove the requirement to maintain copies of leases, since those are legally not property transaction documents and are instead contracts between individuals. And so the state would just be maintaining the electronic copies of the land exchange or the property transaction documents and not the leases. Changing the language would further the department's efforts to move to a more electronic format and reduce the expense of producing and storing paper files. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions on this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I'll say it right. I think you kind of hit on it, but I just wanted to make sure that I'm understanding completely. So this might be a simple question, but I know you couldn't probably say how much, but will it be a significant savings to go to the electronic versus the paper?
Chair Clam, Representative Post, we, just in terms of our reorganization, we've been doing some file cleaning, and in one day of purging files, we cleaned a ton of paper, literally.
Weight ton,
not just figuratively. And so I don't have an exact number for you, but I'm guessing it's significant, because
okay.
You have to consider any property transaction for any state agency. We're holding the papers as well as the agency holding copies of papers.
Follow-up.
Thank you. This would be a significant savings as opposed to what it would cost to transfer over to an electronic system? Will there be some kind of cost involved in that, I assume?
Chair Clem, Representative Post, actually we have an electronic system that we use to manage all of our documents for the unclaimed property program, most of our ownership and permitting documents, and so we believe we have the electronic system in place to handle this.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Chair Clem. And Mr. Chairman, I apologize for asking this question with annoying frequency, but I'll be asking it today and in the future. Director, I see this measure contains an emergency clause, and putting aside for a moment the common use of the word emergency, what's the reason this needs to go into effect on passage rather than under normal statutory circumstances?
Chair Clem, Representative Gomberg, really the urgency is just to not have to continue to carry these paper documents. And so the sooner we can get to it, the better off we will be.
Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, you and I share a great technological wizardry. You with your ability to fix things,
and you with your Star Trek communicator.
Right. Yeah. It flips. So I still need to ask, whenever we're talking about, and I know this is probably not the most sophisticated shift requiring the most sophisticated software, but I don't know if anybody...
They call it scanning.
Scanning. I don't know if any of you agree, but any time I think of the state of Oregon, which I certainly am part of, and data collection and retention and so forth, I get a little nervous until we have examined our abilities and examined what each department has and how archaic it is and what our policy is going forward. So maybe this does not rise to the level of that kind of scrutiny, but I've been very concerned about this type of thing.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, we do handle quite a significant amount of paperwork through an electronic system. It has a lot of information associated with it, so we're very conscientious about our security for our electronic systems. The state as a whole has one layer of security that covers the state system, and then we have another layer of security within our own system as well. We haven't had any breach. But we take our security very seriously. So while I can't guarantee anything, I can assure you that this is, considering the number of other records that we have maintain, this is actually a pretty small portion of all of those records.
So let me ask a question that might make you feel slightly more comfortable. Yeah. The paper version will still be kept at the original agency.
Chair Clem, yes, I didn't understand that question. Yes, there would still be a one paper copy.
So instead of two paper copies, there'd be one paper copy at the agency whose lease it is, mm-hmm. and then the copy of that paper copy would become an electronic
Correct.
Copy.
Excuse me, I had not understood the question.
I'm not sure that's what he meant either. I'm just...
As you know,
more worried about hacking or more worried about, like, there's, you know, the computer burns up and there's no copy anywhere?
The answer to that would be yes.
Yeah.
But, Mr. Chair, that's helpful information about the paper copies, but here on our agenda it says, rather than paper copies. So So that's an important clarification. There still would be a paper copy, apparently.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, that's rather than as it pertains to our department and not to the originating agency that would be involved with the property transaction.
What about if it's your own property?
We'd be keeping it if it's our own property. We'd keep a paper copy as well as an electronic copy.
That might be enough to make me support this over my long-standing vote against anything paperless to support the pulp and paper industry. I might finally vote for a bill that I don't think I ever have that allows something, as long as I know there's some paper being generated somewhere by some timber community. Any more questions on this one for the moment, at least? And actually, it just dawned on me, are these, since they're land transactions, in some cases, I know leases are different, but are there some of these where the county also would be maintaining
certainly
a deed or a title or something?
Almost certainly there'd be something, and title companies as well. Yeah. I mean, this is they're normal documents, the type of documents that you would get if you sold or purchased a home or a piece of land. It's that kind of a property transaction documents. But if you think about buying a home and the pile of papers that you get when you purchase a home, if we have two copies of those running around in paper copy, that's just a lot more really than is necessary, in our opinion.
Any other questions on this one at the moment? A long series of questions on your electronic device. Okay, well, let's. We have no other witnesses on this one either, I don't believe. So let's move on to 2463. And do you actually, Rachel, can you join them from the Marine Board? Okay, great.
All right, great. Thank you, Chair Clam, members of the committee. Once more, for the record, my name is Mary Abrams, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of State Lands. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2463. This bill would establish a submerged lands enhancement fund to be used by the Department of State Lands to improve our management and enhancement of state-owned waterways. So these are the waterways we discussed earlier that we received at statehood as under the Equal Footing Doctrine. The bill would earmark a portion of existing funds, so it's not to create new funds, to remove derelict and abandoned structures on these waterways. And these include things like old pilings, abandoned boats, and just general garbage kind of stuff. We provided in our testimony a copy of some photos that demonstrate the types of things that we're talking about. We manage, as a department, more than 1.2 acres of state-owned waterways to assure public trust uses of navigation, recreation, fisheries, and commerce. In the first three sections of House Bill 2463, you'll find the definition of the derelict structures, our statutory authority to address them, and the process that we would use for removing these structures. This would all be further refined through rulemaking. But the main goal of House Bill 2463 is to provide funds that could be used to clean up these derelict and often dangerous structures on public waterways, and that's in Section 4 of the bill. The department, just in terms of some experience that we've had in the past around derelict structures and the like, the department has partnered with the Marine Board, the Oregon Marine Board, to remove derelict vessels under the authority of the Marine Board. In recent years, the Marine Board has allocated about $150,000 per biennium, and we've matched that with about $25,000 per biennium. But these funds are directed uniquely to vessels and not to the structures. And the structures are equally problematic. They can be a safety risk. If you look at the photos, you can see that they can be a problem for boats, for fishing, just for general use of the waterways. The department, even though it's owned these lands since statehood, has never had a dedicated fund to address this issue. And the department sees a distinct need for a dedicated fund to help clean up the public waterways that we oversee. House Bill 2463 would establish the Submerged Land Enhancement Fund by using a portion of the revenues currently allocated by the department currently collected by the department from waterway authorizations. These are authorizations like leases that Assistant Director Ryan had talked about a bit ago, easements, and registrations. The typical revenue from these authorizations is a little over $1 million a year, so the fund would potentially have in excess of $200,000 a year. Judging from the derelict vessel work that the Oregon Marine Board does, we believe that even that amount could be spent wisely in trying to clean up the waterways that we supervise. We believe this fund will help ensure better stewardship of Oregon's state-owned waterways and, in fact, improve the public's ability to use their own waterways for recreation, commerce, fisheries, and navigation. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Question for Mary on this one.
Again, I apologize. I won't ask this question of every bill, but I'm just fascinated. We've got four bills before us today, one dealing with emergency scanning, one with emergency leasing, and one with emergency easements. But the bill dealing with dangerous structures is not an emergency. Can you help me understand?
Chair Clem, Representative Gomberg, I'm at the
law. This is going to be great, by the way. We've got months of this. This is good. Yes, please.
I think it's a very good question, and I actually don't have a great answer for you other than to say that there's probably a certain period of time that where we go out and address these derelict structures, and I'm assuming that that's not immediately upon passage.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? I love it. It's fantastic. Okay, Rachel, can we take your testimony?
Sure. Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Rachel Graham, and I'm the manager of the Policy and Environmental Section at the State Marine Board. So the State Marine Board is the recreational boating agency for the state, and one of our responsibilities is to remove derelict and abandoned vessels from our waterways. I've overseen the Abandoned Vessel Removal Fund since 2011, and in that time I've worked on over 50 projects, actually the majority of them in this biennium. We did have some improvements made to our process in the last legislative session. House Bill 2233 gave us new tools to help us remove these structures and vessels more quickly. Just a little background for those of you who are not familiar with our removal program. The State Marine Board does set aside $150,000 of boat registration and titling fees every biennium. That's recreational boat registration and titling fees. But we are statutorily limited to funding 75 to 90% of the total removal and disposal cost for vessels. That means we need a local partner or another agency to help us out with the match. Since our very first removal project, the Department of State Lands has stepped up and provided match for vessels abandoned on state-owned waterways. This has been very helpful as the port districts and local sheriff's offices that often deal firsthand with these vessels don't have the funds available to provide the match. Just one quick example, last year, we removed a derelict floating home that actually broke loose in Clatsop County, was floating down the slough and hit a county bridge. So this was a county problem. The sheriff's office brought this to our attention, but it was going to cost about $10,000 to remove this vessel. So State Land stepped up and provided the 25% match so that we could get the project accomplished. So the Marine Board is very supportive of House Bill 2463. The creation of the Submerged Lands Enhancement Fund will allow us to continue to partner together, remove more boats and structures, and also allow State Lands to remove structures that the Marine Board can't remove. We're not authorized to remove old pilings, that type of thing, but their removal will be very beneficial to recreational boaters. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about our removal fund and how we work with State Lands. Thank you.
Yeah, Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I was looking at the pictures earlier, which we finally found on here.
Sorry.
It was my fault. I couldn't figure out where to find them. In regards to, say, the pilings, for instance, as a person who, I love to go crabbing. And so for me, a lot of times those pilings are what I tie to. The reason I ask that is, if this were to pass and become law at some point in the near future, does that mean we're going to just go around and start pulling out these pilings wherever, like starting from the north and going to the south or wherever? Or is there a targeted list, or is it by complaint? What's the process for what we decide what to pull out and what to remove? In other words, you know, these emergencies that you talked about here, that's apparent. But what about like these pilings that are in the pictures?
Chair Klim, Representative Post, I'm assuming that question's for me. Let me just give us a couple of examples. So we have, if you look at the case of, well, really almost anywhere. So the places that you might want to go crabbing down along the coast as well as through the Columbia River, there's a very large, much larger number of these pilings than we would be able to pull out, even with the fund we're talking about. We would be working with local agencies. We have a lot of people who come to us directly and ask for assistance, and those would be our first priorities. We probably have more requests than we would have money for, and so I don't anticipate us going out proactively and taking out pilings where we didn't have some requests.
Okay.
And there is, I might note as well, there is some interest on the part of ports and some of the local communities in working with the removal of those pilings for mitigation, because they are something that oftentimes the old ones are filled with creosote, and they've been a water quality issue as well as a submerged lands issue. And so the ports and the communities look at those as opportunities. If they're pulling them out, they can maybe get credit in terms of some development that they want to do later. And so we're working actively with the ports and communities around those questions. So we would be definitely conscientious about working with the local folks around what they want to have removed.
Okay, thanks.
Representative McClain.
Director, if the Department of Lands didn't have this authority, who would have the, or who would secure a houseboat that has been unmoored and presents a danger on a river?
Chair Klim, Representative McClain, historically what has happened is we've gone ahead and helped out where we can. The problem is that it's much less predictable, and so we can't really plan for these for this work, and as opposed to having a fund that was dedicated to it. And so we literally are called up when there's a big problem and somebody needs some assistance right away, and that isn't always a time when we have the money that we can go out and do it. And so what we try and do is find the resources and partner with other folks who have some resources to help out. The houseboats that are floating down the river are one thing, but the structures that are in place that may be sinking right there, be an eyesore, be a risk to boaters and to swimmers and users of the waterways, there actually isn't anybody who has the authority to go in and get those at this point in time that I know of, other than the local law enforcement. And as was indicated, that's really a money issue for most of the local law enforcement folks. So again, we've tried to help out where we can, but you know, mainly it ends up being sort of a catch-as-catch-can, and that's what we're hoping this fund will sort of end that, the need for that.
May I follow up? So I noticed that in Section 3, Sub 1, there is the right of the Department of Lands to recover costs from the owner of the abandoned structure or derelict structure. Does the Department of State Lands currently have that authority to recover costs? If so, why do you need it?
Chair Klim, Representative McClain, we do have the authority to recover costs on trespasses on our own lands. And the problem with most of these structures is that there generally isn't somebody to recover the cost from. That's why the fund, we believe, is necessary. We do feel that if we were then able to identify someone who owned the structure, we'd like to be able to collect costs if we could.
In follow-up, yep. Mr. Chair. And where did the funds go? Directly to the Department of State Lands or to the fund?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, the funds go to the Department of State Lands that administers the fund. And so they would be used, they'd be earmarked to be used to expend for removal of derelict vessel or derelict structures, excuse me.
And just finally, so the Department of State Lands decides what's an abandoned structure and then has the ability to collect the money from the owner of. But I only see the appeal process just for the fine part, not for the declaration part of the abandoned structure. How does an owner contest just the finding of what's abandoned and what's not?
Chair Clem, Representative McLean, we probably don't have that included. That's probably an error on our part. The idea is that if someone is able to prove that they own the property, the structure, we wouldn't be in the process of removing it. And it would only be if someone stepped forward after we've removed it that we would try and collect the cost of removing it.
You can see the irony that this mm-hmm. section presents.
Yes, I can.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Do you see any?
Chair Clem, if I may, Assistant Director Ryan had something to add to that question for Representative McLean.
Yeah, Chair Clem, Representative McLean. Generally, when a structure is, most of the structures that we have out on state-owned waterways, we actually have a lease or some other contractual agreement with the owner of those structures, the users of those structures. And so this fund is really intended to be used to remove truly abandoned derelict structures where we don't have an entity that actually claims ownership or is using them.
If I might respond.
Yeah.
When an agency says truly, what they're saying to me is, trust me. And, you know, the good paper makes good friends. So I think when you have an appeal process for the fine you assess, but none for the determination of what's abandoned and what's not, it puts you in the precarious position of choosing who pays and who doesn't. And so I think there needs to be a little more process in this for the protection of individuals. But again, what's truly abandoned versus what's legally determined to be abandoned is not comfort to me. I think we need more safeguards.
Chair Clem, can I add to the question? Sure. Structure, we also have the authority to seize and remove floating homes and boathouses under the broad umbrella of vessels. And this is how we've partnered with state lands in the past. And in our statutes, we have outlined a pre-seizure notice and post-seizure notice. So it affords two opportunities before we take action to the owner. And I do believe that this bill references ORS 830-908-948. And in that section, we do have outlined the seizure notification procedures. So that might help to answer potentially how they could use these statutes combined with our chapter to follow a notification process.
I understand on vessels, right?
Yes.
As opposed to structures.
Chair Clem and Representative McLean. So vessels also includes floating homes and boathouses. Because those structures are titled, and actually they're titled by the Marine Board, and we have the ownership records for those type of structures. We would not have ownership records for docks or piling.
Any further questions right this second? We're not doing anything with the bill today anyway, so it gives you some time to talk further. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in general terms, can you give us an idea of your capability, both at the Marine Board and at the Department, your Navy, if you will, the capability you have now to rescue these, aside from the assistance you might get from law enforcement.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, I'll let the Marine Board respond for their part. For us, we would be contracting with people to go out and recover and deal with these structures.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, yes, that we contract for the removal of all structures. And the largest structure we've removed is a 60-foot by 65-foot floating home. So we do put those type of removal projects out to bid.
And this fund would obviously help with more of that.
Any further questions at this point on this one? Okay. So, Rachel, you're, unless you're here on the next one, I think you're excused. And why don't you then tell us about the last one, and then we'll take testimony from the public on it. That's 2460.
Chair Clem, committee members, once again, for the record, my name is Bill Ryan, Assistant Director of the Aquatic Resource Management Program at the Department of State Lands, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2460. The bill would allow the Department of State Lands to recover administrative costs for processing applications for public utility easements on state-owned lands. And the bill summary focuses on the definition of land. However, the main purpose of the bill is to allow our agency to assess an administrative fee for what to date has been an exemption for utilities from paying any fees for locating their facilities on state land outside of cities. As Mary described in the overview, the department manages submerged and submersible lands, commonly known as the beds and banks under navigable and tidally influenced waterways, and that includes the territorial sea, which is from the low tide mark out to 3 miles from that low tide mark. Our review and oversight of applications for easements is focused on protecting the public trust rights of navigation, recreation, fisheries, and commerce on those waterways. And when a use is proposed on these lands, such as a commercial marina or a cable crossing, utility crossing, the department assesses a fee, rent, or consideration to partially compensate for the loss of public trust rights, and an application fee to partially cover the administrative costs to review the proposed use and issue an authorization, usually a lease or an easement. All revenue from the waterway authorizations is deposited into the Common School Fund, and the earnings from that fund are distributed twice a year to Oregon's K-12 public school districts. To provide some background, in the early part of the 20th century, Oregon was committed to bringing electricity and other utilities to rural parts of the state, and the legislature helped to facilitate that process through certain actions, such as granting utilities the right to construct, maintain, and operate service lines and fixtures across rivers or other lands belonging to the state free of charge, and that's in ORS 758.010. This policy is now out of step with our oversight administration of other types of authorizations on state lands, and it doesn't match up with what our sister states in Washington and California are doing with these things as well. We estimate the department would receive approximately $24,000 in these fees in the coming biennium, and that's based upon the current fee for other leases, which is $750 in most areas, and then it's actually $5,000 in the territorial sea. And thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions initially? We'll probably ask them to be back at the end, too, to answer questions post other testimony.
Would it be better to ask questions then after?
No, not necessarily. Go ahead.
I got a couple of questions then, Mr. Chair. You know, on 2461, you didn't get any questions because you were lowering costs. But you can imagine when we see administrative costs by rule, we have questions about a few more of the details. So can you say more about what types of administrative costs the fee that you just described would cover?
Yes, Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam. So there's a process. So when someone applies to have an easement, say a utility line across a state-owned waterway, there's a process of us, you know, reviewing the application, making sure it's complete, calculating the value of the easement, and then also a public review process, because you know we're looking at protecting public trust values there. So there's actually a public notification and reception of comments from the public on those. Then there's a negotiation with the applicant regarding the conditions of the easement or the lease,
and then wrapping that process up. So, not all applications are equal. Some are really quick and smooth. Some can take a considerable amount of effort and back and forth, depending upon the nature of the application of the property and of the amount of public concern and input regarding that application.
One follow-up.
Sure.
So, without this bill, under your current situation and authority, what's the level of administrative cost to the department in this area? Do you have a rough figure on that?
Chair Clem and Representative Gilliam, based our estimate on what our cost would be for the coming biennium is about $24,000, and we think that's about what we're spending in administrative costs when we're not charging for these. So this is work that we're currently doing, we're just not charging a fee for it.
So the one last follow-up. Mm-hmm. So the goal is to cover what you're currently putting out, because that's the number you used at the beginning.
Chair Clem, Representative Gilliam, yes. Partially.
Versus if you don't get this bill, you use the common school fund to pay the cost or something?
Chair Clem, yes, that's what we bring in revenue for the common school fund, and we deposit that into the corpus for the operating expenses for the department. We take that money out of the common school fund. And so those areas that we don't cover by fees for our administrative work are monies that come out of the common school fund.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm of the old school of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. What's broke?
Chair Clem, Representative Post, well, we believe what's broke is the fact that the Common School Fund is subsidizing the administrative costs of easements that are provided to private utilities. We have on our constitutional lands, there's a requirement that we effectively charge for what we use them for so that we can get money. On our waterways, we don't have the constitutional mandate, but we do support the work that we do on our waterways through the Common School Fund. And so we believe that where we can remove a subsidy from the Common School Fund, that's a benefit.
One follow-up.
Sure.
How exactly will the Department of State Lands collect this?
Chair Clem, Representative Post, we'll collect it the same way we do our administrative fees currently for our other easements and our other authorizations that we issue.
Which is?
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Chair Clem, Representative Post, through an application fee, so when someone submits an application to the department, they submit the fee with that application.
Same.
And it's currently $750 for most uses.
And do they get their money back if it's rejected?
Actually, I'm not sure. I'll have to check on that, but I don't know.
We do return money on some authorizations, but I don't know whether we do on easement applications, so we can check on that.
Vice Chair Post.
Yeah. Will there be transparency regarding the costs incurred and the fees charged?
We're going to do it through rule. Chair Clem, Vice Chair Post, we would be establishing the cost through rulemaking, so there'd be a rulemaking advisory committee that would be involved with that discussion.
Do you have any idea what the other states charge, Washington or California?
Chair Clem, I don't have the numbers on top of my head, but I know that they're substantially more because they actually charge for compensation and not just administrative fees.
And, Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have three questions in one. The first, in the Section 1, there's two definitional changes, essentially. I think I know the answer to the first one, but I want you to confirm the elimination of the word corporation. And then let me ask you, too, the definition of over any lands and on land seems awfully similar. You must have some motivation for making the change, and I want to make sure that I understand that. And then I have a follow-up question related to the interaction between this cleanup language and the fees that I'll ask after this, after I hear your answers.
Okay. Chair Clem, Vice Chair Helm, I actually don't know the background of eliminating corporations, so I can find that out for you unless Assistant Director.
I have,
no.
Are they all persons now?
I wasn't going to go into this, but I am fairly positive LC has done this because they, you know, believe corporations are people, but I didn't want to get into that whole debate here over this bill, but we may have to because I'm pretty sure that's what LC did. Yeah, okay. But we can check.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Clem. That's what I thought.
All right. Answer that, but maybe the Legislative Council can. For the overlands and onlands language, that's because we have both our uplands where you have utilities perhaps going across the lands, and then we have the submerged and submersible lands where they might be over the lands because they're submerged and submersible.
Would this language allow below ground installation of utility lines below submersible lands?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Helm, I do not know 100%. I know the intent would be to cover them because that is the most common way to install utilities at this point in time. But I don't know for sure. So let me check on that and get back to you.
And then as a follow-up, I'm a little bit worried when legislation is proposed that combines a fee change with some cleanup language. And here I'm concerned that under the auspices of a fee change, we may be changing the scope of the department's authority. So I want to ask you, do you think that the definitional changes that we've just discussed in any way either increase or decrease the scope of the department's authority?
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Helm, I'm not an expert as Legislative Council is in crafting statutory language. Our intent was not to change our authority, but rather to collect administrative fee for what we already provide, which is easements across our lands.
Thank you.
Okay, so we've got a pretty good list. Why don't we get into those folks, and then we may have more questions later. So why don't I start with Varner Seaman, Ted Case, and Beth Vargas Duncan.
LC is sort of directed Bill Draft here to eliminate what now might be under federal law. A redundancy corporations.
Ted, you don't want to start about why you're subsidizing school children or vice versa, you sure? All right, Varner.
Great. Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seam, and I work for Portland General Electric in the Government Affairs Department. Thanks very much for your time today. Really appreciate you taking the time to hear some concerns about this bill. First off, I think that the specific issue that that PGE and I'm pretty sure some of the other utilities have is less a little bit with the cleanup language that's taking place in this bill and more with the sub B on the second page of the draft bill that deals with the fee schedule. We want to start off for a second talking about what the history of this is. It was alluded to a little bit earlier, but there is, I think, a legitimate public purpose around not charging the fees historically for use of the right-of-way along state lands. The first reason, there are two I want to talk about. The first is that the notion is that if largely what we're talking about in terms of the use of the right-of-way over state lands is trying to kind of consolidate some of the development and the disturbance that takes place into one corridor. So if you build a road through a rural part of the state over state lands, you don't want to be stringing transmission lines and distribution lines kind of over this field over here and that field over there and this field over there, and getting into a situation where if you're looking at putting up those lines and you're putting a pretty significant investment into putting up those lines, that you're getting into a conversation about, well, it's going to be 50 cents a foot over here or a buck a foot over there, and you're creating an economic incentive to spread out those impacts. If you have, if you're originally, and this statute goes back a pretty long time, back to, as our attorneys looked at it, actually pre-1900 is our belief in terms of when this stuff came around. So it's a pretty long-standing statute. And so the idea was, if you have people build transmission and distribution lines right next to the roadway, you're consolidating the impact. So that was the first one, is basically to kind of, you know, minimize the impact and keep the state pretty and, you know, minimize surface disturbance, species impacts, all those other things. The second is that there is, a, generally speaking, a public good for lowering the cost of electricity and lowering the cost of putting in that infrastructure for distribution and transmission. I think part of it is that we had, you know, prior to rural electrification in the state of Oregon, the state looked pretty different. And I think most folks would say today it's pretty hard to have a functioning modern economy without having electricity. That's just one of those basic things that we take for granted in this day and age, but back at the time we didn't necessarily. And I think one of the things that can get to be a little bit of a construct, and I think a misunderstanding about the role of utilities versus taxpayers versus schools, is it isn't necessarily that we're talking about a different set of folks. For investor-owned utilities like Portland General Electric, PacifiCorp, Idaho Power, as well as for public utilities in the state, things like fees and permitting are costs that we incur. These are expenses that get put into rates that get passed back on to consumers or to the customers, both the business, the commercial, and the residential customers that we have. So saying, on the one hand, we've got, you know, taxpayers over here and ratepayers over there, they're the same folks. So to say, well, you know, you're taking from this person, you're giving to this person, you're talking about kind of a wealth transfer between basically the same people. And so some of the notion around not charging for the access to these rights of way was to minimize the cost of putting this infrastructure because it was a public good. What we're concerned about in particular with this language is not necessarily, you know, that we want to be a drain on the common school fund or that we want to be adversarial with the state in any way. But what we're concerned about is, one, the when we look at the language in this section, it's pretty broad. It talks about administrative costs reasonably calculated. There aren't necessarily sideboards that are put on to what those administrative costs are. My reasonable and your reasonable may not be the same. And so we have some concern. We've seen in, for Portland General Electric, we've seen in some other jurisdictions where we've been charged for administrative costs and we've taken some issue in terms of what actually gets rolled into that definition. I think the gentleman in the last panel was talking about if there's public notice, if there's a contested case, not all hearings are the same. If you're putting in several miles of transmission line and somebody decides to sue over that, do all of a sudden legal fees get rolled into it? So you can start to get a pretty broad, you know, what is the definition of administrative costs? How do we keep the definition relatively narrow? And I think the short version of it is we haven't, and in terms of, actually just to note in terms of the costs, $750 was referenced as the current permit cost. That's not in the legislation. That's not in the bill. That may end up being a reasonable number. I don't know right now. But it isn't what's put into the bill that's in front of you right now. The biggest concern that we have is that there had been some discussion about this several months ago that one of my colleagues had with DSL. We hadn't had some discussion prior to this legislation coming forward. We haven't really sat down and worked out with DSL what the appropriate language should be, or getting some common understanding in terms of what we should have here. And our concern is, you know, we've got something that's been in statute for, you know, well over 100 years. We think having a couple of weeks to take a pause and have parties have a chance to go back and look at this language and sit around a table and talk through this and see what we need to do here and see if we can't work out something would be our preference. Thank you.
Ted? Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. We represent 18 electric co-ops in Oregon, about 200,000 members over some of the most rural and remote parts of the state. I want to associate myself with Mr. Seaman on his position on this. We represent the big swath of the state with very little people. We have one co-op out in eastern Oregon that's the size of West Virginia. We cross a lot of state lands. We really don't know the ramifications of this legislation, I heard for the first time this $24,000 figure. That was interesting, but as Varner said, there's a lot of open-endedness to this, to the language in here. I think caution the committee to take some time to take a look, see where that is going to be assessed. I have one co-op that has 10 employees out based in Monument, Oregon. Most of you, probably other than Representative McLean, have never even heard of that community. It's very small. Probably couldn't find.
Mr. Chair,
Monument. Monument.
But it's about 5 hours from here. It's a town of about 125 people, and the biggest load is the school. So we're very sensitive to the schools. There's 40 kids in it. There's no third graders. So these are the people that I have to look out for, and I hope that you look out for them as well, as we tend to look where these costs would be borne. So, again, I urge the committee to be cautious on this. I think Representative Post said, you know, what's broke about this? I'm not sure anything is broke. But if it is broken, we can certainly take some time to put some sideboards on this legislation, take a little time to see where that impact would be. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Beth?
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Beth Vargas Duncan, the Executive Director at Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We are 11, I represent 11 municipally owned city utilities in Oregon. You've received a handout. All those are listed at the bottom of that, of my testimony. And we are governmental entities created under ORS Section 190 through an intergovernmental agreement. So that's how OMEU was formed, and we come together to support the collective interests of OMEU. I do want to state up front that I believe in looking at the legislation, and it's already been mentioned that it excludes within the city limits. This legislation, however, doesn't address our municipal electric utilities that also provide service outside city limits. And so I did some inquiry more recently, as I found that this could definitely apply to our members. And I found that we have a number of examples where our municipal electric utilities are servicing outside their city limits. So what I have, and I don't have a complete list, but just some examples, is a city abandoned, population 3,000 or a little over. Services in ODOT, Oregon Department of Transportation Waste Station, a fish hatchery, which their brand new city manager who was talking to me about this says, I know it takes a considerable amount of energy, so we don't have specifics, but we can get further details if needed, and a state park. We also have the city of Cascade Locks, which is in the Gorge, population just over 1,200 persons, services about 26 miles by half mile wide, state land in a national scenic area. We also have the city of Drain, and the city of Drain, I don't know exactly, but some, about a half a dozen people, I think, work for the city of Drain. And the city manager there told me this morning that they provide electric service to the state highway via the right-of-ways. So we did just learn what the fee would be. We hadn't had an opportunity to talk to those at state lands to learn more details about what the impact. But certainly, where there had been no fee historically, and again, Mr. Seaman already went over that, to add a fee like this would definitely be an impact on these very small municipal, you know, city-owned utilities, public utilities, and with their very narrow overhead, likely it would have to be passed through rates. And as I just listed, a number of these are state-owned entities, so we would just be switching funds around, increasing rates. The state would pay a higher rate, and then it goes back. So I don't know about the efficiency of that and moving from one fund to the other, but that is also another point. We don't have an official position because I haven't had an opportunity to convene our public body and take a policy position on this, but I do know that individual city managers and utility general managers have indicated their opposition to me, who are members of OMEU. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Thank you.
One thing that I probably need to make sure I've got square and your members too, I'm not sure that this is meant to apply to all state-owned properties versus the ones owned by state lands. So if ODF&W has a hatchery that they own, that would be not subject to this, for example. But if it's the Elliott Forest, yes, it would be. Or if ODOT owns the land underneath their facility, no. But, you know, some other piece outside of Bend that DSL happens to own, yes. And so I'm wondering a little bit if people were worried about all state-owned properties versus the ones owned by the DSL particularly, which is a very, I think, probably small subset of everything that the state owns, potentially. Is that?
That's correct.
Yeah. So we might, in this period of talking about fees, also talk about what the scope of what actually is covered under the bill and how many of these are and where they are, because the fear level might be a lot higher than it needs to be based on who owns, you know, what the DSL actually owns that would be in play.
If I may,
yeah,
Chair Clem. So I understand what you're saying. I think it would be excellent to get more of that cleared up. I think, too, when we first looked at this as cities, you know, we weren't certain that this directly would apply to us. But in considering this, you know, we'd have to do further investigation, actually, because it was rather late that we started realizing that it may apply. So I think some clarification would be useful as to the intention of it actually applying to whom, public utilities, and also who owns the land. It will take us more investigation to find out how that would impact us.
Luckily, we have time. Okay, any questions for these three? Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Barb Young, Aaron Doyle, and Sean Gillians. I don't even know what Avista Corp is, but I'm sure we'll hear in a moment. Barbara, I've got you first.
Sure. Barb Young, I'm the legislative director for CenturyLink in Oregon, and I just have very brief comments because a couple of things have been covered already. So the first issue was just clarifying that it truly is restricted to just state land property, and it's not expanded to include either state highway or public right-of-way. That was a little bit unclear to me when I first read this. So if it's a very narrow state land approach here, that's one issue. If it's unintentionally, this legislation is unintentionally broadening it, then we have major concerns. Secondly, the application fee, same concerns as other folks have mentioned, in that is $750 the cap? Does it vary depending on the complexity of the application? I know the language in the bill suggests a permit fee schedule. That tells me maybe it's not just one rate. So I'm very interested in what that fee schedule would look like. And then lastly, and this is kind of more specific to communication companies, because CenturyLink has traditionally been classified as a utility, we end up getting thrown into these utility-type applications. And we just, and I feel compelled to argue every time this comes up, that if we're going to pay an application fee and our competitors are not going to pay one to cross state lands, then I get really grumpy. So that's just, I'd like to bring that up. And again, part of it is just that legacy association with being a utility. So those are my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, Aaron.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. We are going to express similar concerns that some other folks have already expressed, but you might be wondering why cities would care, because it sounds like a lot of electric companies, but we also provide utilities that might cut through state land areas, particularly if you look at our water and wastewater piping and infrastructure. At some point, you have to get to that source water, and there might be Department of State lands in play. What we're hoping for is that transparency that Representative Post mentioned in how they establish this fee, how it's applied, and we've had very little time to consider what lands and what infrastructure and what cities would be impacted by this, so we would like to encourage taking a little bit more time and possibly setting some more sideboards on exactly what administrative costs are so that we can make sure that we're not accidentally tipping the infrastructure project budget, which it doesn't sound like it's going to be, but we want more time. Thank you.
Avista? I mean, Sean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sean Jillian's representing Avista. Avista is an investor-owned utility providing natural gas service in southern and eastern Oregon, basically southern and eastern Oregon's version of Northwest Natural Gas. And I won't continue to belabor the point about the fee schedule and the lack of any sideboards on it, but that's obviously a concern to us as well. The other thing that I would add, as far as the natural gas perspective of it, while the rest of the state is definitely electrified and a lot has changed since 1900s, for natural gas, there are still a number of communities that do not have natural gas service and are more rural areas of the state, which is what our company represents and serves. And the most questions I've gotten since I've started to represent them is, how can we get natural gas in our community for economic development purposes? Is it possible to get it there? And what we found thus far in looking at some areas in Representative McLean's district and other areas, it's just cost prohibitive to run the piping out there to actually recoup the costs that ratepayers ultimately are going to have to pay to provide that service. Any additional fees when you don't know exactly what you're looking at there, especially with legislation like this, make that even more difficult to expand service territory into more rural parts of the state. So those are our concerns, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions for this group? Okay, thank you. And then Sean and Danelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of PacifiCorp, an electric utility operates in Oregon as Pacific Power. And, you know, we also share the same concerns that you've heard the prior panel, so I won't repeat that. But if you look at our service territory, mostly rural, whether it's north coast, central coast, south coast, central Oregon, all the way into Wallowa County in eastern Oregon, this could have significant impact on our company. And so we're obviously more than willing to have further conversations with the state. I think really appreciate the questions asked by the committee today, because these are the same questions that our company has been mulling over since the bill was printed. So, you know, again, we're always open to having these further conversations with the state, and would like at least time to do that. Thank you.
Hi, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Danelle Romain. My father and I represent the Oregon PUD Association, which is five electric PUDs that cover the state of Oregon. We're on the Oregon coast, Tillamook, Newport, much of the northern Oregon coast, the Dalles, Eugene, up Highway 30. So same concerns as all the other utility groups. We're a consumer-owned utility. We're a nonprofit. Any new fee gets passed on to our customers in the form of increase in their cost of a basic service, electricity. So we look forward to working with the department on whatever happens with this bill. So thanks for your time.
Any questions for these two? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Miller, if this went forward the way it's written, and I don't know if you can speak for the company or not, but would you be willing to exempt soccer fields that might have become drenched and submergible?
Withdrawn, Mr. Chair.
Any other really good questions? Not seeing none, you're excused. Anybody else here on this that would like to testify? Mr. Landau, you're just going to sit there and nod and shake your head vigorously in the audience and agree and not even sign up, huh? No? Okay, then. Oh, good. I've coaxed you in.
Nice.
Actually, we need to put you under oath before we get started.
Thank you for the invitation, Mr. Chair. Mark Landau, representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. We represent approximately 950 districts across the state, providing a variety of different single services to the citizens of Oregon, including, of course, water, wastewater. We have the same concerns as others, and we would be pleased to join any conversation. Most, if not all, of the concerns have already been expressed, and thank you for inviting me.
Should we have you chair the work group, Mr. Landauer?
It's an honor that's too great for me. Thank you.
Let's see, Representative Witt's not here. Maybe he can do that. Okay.
Yeah, that's
all right.
Thank you.
Thanks. And anybody else? I will harass no one else in the audience. So let me close the public hearings on House Bills 2460, 2461, 2462, and 2463.
Okay.
So I think that is all of our business. Anything else for the good of the order? I will adjourn our committee. I will adjourn our committee.